The Double X Gab Fest is brought to you by Harry's, the new shaving company that offers German-engineered blades, well-designed handles, and shipping right to your door. To get $5 off your first purchase in time for the holidays, visit harrys.com and use the promo code Double X. That's D-O-U-B-L-E-X. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the Double X Gabfest for Thursday, November 27th, the Butch Goddess edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Double X. I'm joined in the DC studio today by Slate writer Katie Waldman. Hi, Katie. Hi, Slate. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Hannah.
I'm just so excited to have a human with me.
I speak on behalf of the institution, the hallowed institution of Slate.
Of course you do. And we're joined in New York by June Thomas, editor of Outward. I'm going to stop saying LGBTQ blog. My listeners by now should know what Outward is. So hi, June.
They surely should. Hey, Hannah. Hey, Katie.
So our three topics for today. First, we're going to talk about a story in this month's Rolling Stone about a gang rape that happened at a University of Virginia fraternity and how it prompts the university to suspend all frat activities. Second, a new study showing that husbands, not children, are what holds women's careers back. And third, does the new Hunger Games movie show us what a feminine utopia would look like? Okay, let's move on to our first topic. In this month's Rolling Stone, Sabrina Rubin-Erdely reports on a shocking 2012 incident that took place at a UVA frat. She describes how a girl named Jackie followed her date upstairs at a frat party into a dark room. She was then pinned down and essentially gang raped by a group of frat boys while a couple of other boys looked on. Erdely looks into the party culture at UVA and then how the administration responded. Sabrina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So how did you find Jackie, first of all?
Well, I looked around at a number of different campuses. It took me a while to figure out where I wanted to focus on. But when I finally decided on University of Virginia, one of the compelling reasons that made me focus on University of Virginia was when I found Jackie. I made contact with a student activist at the school who told me a lot about the culture of the school. That was one of the sort of important things, sort of criteria that I wanted when I was looking for the right school to focus on. And then I'd asked her to put me in touch with other rape survivors, and she had mentioned a bunch of people with different situations, and she had kind of casually mentioned that she knew somebody who had been gang raped. And she had mentioned it in the context of we had been talking about self-blame and so forth, and she was telling me that even in the situation of this horrendous gang rape, there was somebody who had been who just really continued to blame herself. And my ears just totally pricked up because I was like, gang rape? I mean, that was just something I did not really expect to find. So in any event, my net got wider and wider. Each survivor that I talked to introduced me to more. And, you know, Jackie was one of the first people that I did get in touch with, but I just kept coming back to her. Her story was just so compelling that she basically, you know, kind of overtook the story.
And can you tell us a little bit about what, for our listeners, what Jackie told you? Kind of how did the story unfold? Did she tell you right away? Did the details come out slowly?
That was one thing that surprised me. The details came out right away. The minute we got on the phone, she was so ready to tell her story that she was a freshman at University of Virginia, just a few weeks into her freshman year, having the time of her life. I mean, she said that the first month of her freshman year was just like the happiest 4 weeks that she'd ever had. And she had been invited out on a date by this handsome junior who invited her out to dinner and then to a fraternity party. And at that party, he invited her up the stairs into a bedroom, and she says that waiting in that bedroom, it was pitch black in there, were seven men who took turns gang raping her for the next 3 hours while her date and another guy gave them encouragement and instruction.
It's just a crazy story.
I know it boggles the mind. It boggles the mind. But then it becomes even more disturbing when I found out that Jackie told me that she had actually told her friends who had discouraged her from reporting and who had totally downplayed the situation. She had eventually kind of, you know, mustered up the courage to tell the administration that she had been brutally gang raped, and that the university did nothing with this information, and that they continued to do nothing even when she eventually then told them that she had become aware of two other women who were also gang raped at that same fraternity. So the idea that this was some kind of culture in which there was so much indifference and apathy towards rape victims. It was radiating everywhere, from the student body, from the administration itself. I felt like, you know, this was just something that I did not really expect to find.
Before we get to the administration's response, because that's like an unfolding story, which has been amazing to watch, what about Drew or who these guys are? Like, do you have a sense of who they are or who Drew is? I mean, you call him Drew. I don't know if that's his name, but...
That's not his name. That's a pseudonym.
So who is he?
Well, I don't want to say much about them as individuals, but I'll just say that this particular fraternity, Phi Kappa Psi, it's really emblematic in a lot of ways of sort of like elitist fraternity culture. It's considered to be a kind of top-tier fraternity at University of Virginia, even though I've seen a lot of chatter online about like, oh, it's not really top-tier, you know. But it's considered to be like a really high-ranking fraternity at University of Virginia, in part because they're just so incredibly wealthy. Their alumni are very influential. You know, they're on Wall Street. They're in politics. One, like, really sort of tangible bit of their sort of totem, I guess, of this fraternity status is that they have the biggest and best fraternity house that has the best piece of real estate on all of Rugby Road, which is, like, their legendary fraternity strip.
Yeah, I think there was a photograph of the frat house, actually, in the story. But did they say anything? Like, did they respond about this? Did they deny it? Sort of, what was their response to the allegation?
There was never needed for a response until I stepped in, apparently, because it wasn't until I started asking questions that the university put them under some kind of investigation, or so they said. It was unclear to me whether there was actually an investigation. The university said that they were under investigation, but when I spoke to the Phi Psi chapter and also to the Phi Psi national representative, both of them said that they were not aware of any kind of university investigation. But both said that they had been informed by the university that there was some kind of hazy allegation that had been made. They both said that they hadn't really been told about any kind of specifics, and that without any real information to go on, they weren't able to do any kind of investigation on their own.
But did the boys say anything to you, or did they say any? I mean, the thing about it is everybody in the story seems to know who they are. Like, there were her friends who were saying, oh, yeah, I mean, he's on her lifeguard shift. And then there was that other guy in her anthropology class. Like, I just wondered.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt that, I mean, the people in, you know, people seem to know who these people are. And it also, I mean, I would speculate that life inside of a frat house is probably, you know, you have this kind of communal life where everybody's sort of sharing information. It's a life where, you know, people are living their lives very closely with one another. And it seems impossible to imagine that people didn't know about this, so that some people didn't know about this. Maybe not everybody. It's a fairly large fraternity. There's something like 82 brothers mm-hmm. that are currently in there. But it seems impossible to imagine that people did not know about it.
Did they try and contact you? Did you try and call them? Like, was there any communication between you and them?
Yeah, I reached out to them in multiple ways. They were kind of hard to get in touch with because their contact page was pretty outdated. But I wound up getting in touch with their local president, mm-hmm. who sent me an email, and then I talked with their national guy, who's kind of like their national crisis manager. You know,
boys. Like,
they're both helpful in their own way, I guess. You know, I mean, all they really said was, you know, this is a. They both claim to have been really shocked by the allegations when they were told by the university, and they mm-hmm. both said that this is a really tragic thing. And, you know, if only we had more information, we could look into it. And, you know, that's the end of that. You know?
I mean, the thing that's hard to get your head around is, like, this is not, you know, we've read lots of campus sexual assault stories. I mean, this is like a really serious gang rape. Like, it's a highly criminal thing. Like, I couldn't, it doesn't seem, like, I know we're talking about it like it's the norm, but the situation seems so unbelievably extreme that a guy would take a freshman and orchestrate a gang rape that, you know, like, people like that should be immediately in prison. So I would think if the university heard any hint of such a story, like, you would call the police and say, get this psycho out of our school. Like, it's not a casual thing, unless you think it was like a hazing ritual that got encouraged. Like, that's why I couldn't pin down sort of what you were actually saying about the boys and sort of which category we should think of them in.
Oh, I see. Like, are they serial rapists or is this some kind of initiation?
It's a gang rape. Like, they smashed her over a glass table. You know, they told five or six people to rape her. It seems like... You know, how could that can be the norm? I mean, that seems such an extreme situation.
No, it is incredibly extreme. I mean, whether this was, perpetrated by, like a serial rapist who has like, you know, many victims. You know, I mean, it seems like no matter what, this was. I mean, this is an incredibly messed up situation, but it was absolutely a violent crime. And I think what was really telling was the idea that, and this really underscores the entire article, is that the student body and the administration doesn't really treat rape as a crime, as a violent crime. They treat it in general as some kind of behavioral problem. And this is why this case blew my mind, that Jackie situation blew my mind, that even in a situation that was so extreme and so obviously within the realm of, you know, criminal, that they would seek to suppress something like this. I mean, because that's really what they did. They, you know, they didn't, not only did they not report it to police, but I mean, really, she was kind of, you know, I feel she was sort of discouraged from moving this forward. I mean, I would think that the first thing that they would do would be to tell her, you know, this needs to go to the police. These are dangerous people who are hurting people. If they hurt you, and, you know, and she heard them saying things during the rape like, oh, you know, you have to, you know, egging each other on, saying things like, don't you want to be a brother, which seemed to indicate that this is some kind of initiation ritual.
Sabrina, one of the things that you talk about is how there are kind of three options, that Dina Ramo presented Jackie with three options, as you know, all people in this position do. That you can sort of do an informal report, you can take it to the police, or you can have a kind of an internal investigation, an investigation at the school. And has Jackie done any of those things at this point?
She has not. She's done none of those things.
And is there any limit on how long she can wait? I mean, it's striking that she's so willing to talk to you. As you said, you know, she told you the story the first time you talked to her, but she hasn't. Is it that she hasn't decided which of the options she wants to take?
I think it's a couple of things.
Okay.
I think that one is that she's incredibly, she's very traumatized by this whole situation. And she's very afraid of the men who she's saying did these things to her. She's particularly afraid of Drew, who she has assigned a tremendous amount of power in her own mind. You know, he's this person who, you know, really, by orchestrating this, you know, he transformed her from this happy person she was before into a person that, you know, she describes herself as being like an empty shell. So I think that the idea of facing him or them down in any way is really just emotionally crippling for her. She's having a very hard time facing up to that. And I think that she needs a lot of support if she's going to get to the place where she can actually confront them. When she does actually run into some of her alleged assailants on campus sometimes. She recognizes them all. She can identify them all. And when she sees them, just the sight of them is obviously a shock, but it also tends to send her into a depression. So it just goes to show sort of the emotional toll that something like this would take. And I just think it would require a great deal of support for her to move forward into any of these options to resolve her case. And that's something that's been completely absent. She really has not had any of that support from her friends, from the administration, nor from her family.
Sabrina, could you talk a little bit more about the relationship between like the community of survivors or alleged victims and the university, particularly Dean Aramo? But, I mean, there were lines in the article that implied that they had so much faith in the university and they believe, oh, you know, UVA loves us, they care about us, and they had faith in the institution. But it also seems like there would be grounds for a lot of anger. And I'm just wondering, like, what the general sense was you got of like how these women thought about the institution and the people who were tasked with helping them?
What I found is that UVA is a place where their culture is one of extreme loyalty. So I guess it shouldn't have surprised me that the community of survivors, they're totally devoted to the university, even as they're not very happy with the way that their cases are handled. They totally buy into the attitude that radiates from the administration that doing nothing is a fine option. You know, if you unburden yourself to the dean and take care of your own mental health, then that's good enough. And they created this support group, you know, which is great for them, and they do activism, they do bystander support seminars, intervention seminars and things like that, which is great. But really what they're kind of doing is affirming one another's choices not to report, which is, of course, an echo of their own administration's, you know, kind of ethos.
Yeah, I saw that. The reactions have been interesting. Mm-hmm. Just a last thing. So the way this will probably spin out now is the university will do some kind of investigation. I imagine they'll find these guys and put them on the record. And it's possible the guys will just deny it, right? Because everyone knows who Drew was on her lifeguard shift. He can't be that hard to find, you know? And so how will Jackie prove her case? Like, what made you believe that her story was true? What were the most convincing? If you were her lawyer in court, what would make you – how would you prove her case?
Well, look, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a journalist. But I will just say that I found her story to be very – I found her to be very credible.
Uh-huh.
She, you know, I put her story through the ringer to the extent that I could. I spoke to, you know, virtually all of her friends to find out what she had told them at various points.
And those matched? Like the friend she spoke to at the time said, yes, she had bruises from going through the glass table or whatever?
Well, I found it to be very consistent. And I think that, and, you know, the degree of her trauma, like there's no doubt in my mind that something happened to her that night.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly happened, you know, I wasn't in that room. I don't know. And I do tell it from her point of view. But
right.
my hope is that, I mean, it's my great hope that she'll be able to kind of come forward and be able to hold these men accountable, you know, in criminal court.
Well, thank you, Sabrina. I really appreciate you coming on to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's pull back and talk about this a little bit. June, what's been the university's response? It's been kind of remarkable since this Rolling Stone story came out.
Yeah, it seems like things are changing every day, but I know that the frats have been suspended only until January. But given the strength of the Greek system, which always that term always amuses me a little bit, at UVA, that's in of its, even if it's for a short time, it's still a pretty huge move. You know, I'm sure that the December is a big time for the frats. And so the fact that they're just been essentially been closed down at least through the end of this year seems pretty significant.
I mean, it's a big time except for the weeks that they're on vacation, right?
Yeah,
so
it
might actually be more like a slap on the wrist.
At the same time, the fact that UVA has taken these responses, and the fact that all these professors have come around, you know, Slate had a piece the other day from a music professor at UVA who said, nothing about this surprises me. That's not journalistic proof, but it's a sort of an indication that no one is particularly surprised, even by an accusation of this strength. That doesn't mean that the accusation is proved. But it does mean that there is a lot of discomfort, to say the least, on this campus. And, you know, people have also pointed out that it's brought attention to this odd way that sexual assault charges are handled on all university campuses. Dahlia Lithwick had a piece in Slate that had the line, how can a crime as serious as aggravated, premeditated gang rape be funneled into an internal disciplinary process?
Right. Well, one thing good that will come out of the story, no matter what, is, you know, the culture, that Rugby Road song, which is pretty despicable, which he quotes throughout the story, which essentially condones, you know, raping semi-conscious freshman girls who you ply with drink and bring to your frat house. Just the whole culture is really going to be under assault, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
No matter what.
Right. And just this whole idea of, you know, the way that the system is set up, the Title IX system of internal investigations, which was started because there was a thought that, you know, the whole, you know, that taking accusations of sexual assault to the usual law enforcement processes is a brutalizing experience for the accuser. And I think now there's a real realization that these internal processes may not be brutalizing, but they are not sort of bringing justice to hand either.
Well, let's just say we are looking forward to having this story play out and seeing what effects this has, because it's really, you know, we've been talking about campus sexual assault for a long time, but this one is really explosive and likely to continue to cause waves. Can we agree on that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now let's move on to our second topic, which is how husbands hold their wives' careers back. But before we do that, we're going to hear from our new sponsor, just in time for the gift-giving season. June, take it away.
I must start with a confession. I really love the gift-giving aspect of this time of year. There's nothing more satisfying than really matching a gift with the person that you have on your list. And another confession is that I often give people what I want. And thanks to Harry's, our new sponsor, harrys.com, I feel like I have a gift for the men in my life. And that is this kind of amazing little basket. I have it in front of me, actually. I have the Harry's Winter Winston set in front of me. You get a sleek chrome razor, 3 high-quality blades, their amazing foaming shave gel, which I smelled, and it has a kind of a slightly medicinal but also very bracing and manly quality about it.
Oh my God, June, you should be like a perfume describer.
And it's already wrapped and shipping is free. So the thing about this gift that seems appealing, men usually shave, I'm led to believe. And personally, I like it when they do. I don't like that sort of messy business. And this is a really nice package. It looks good. It smells good. And it's super convenient. And it's something that they need. And so that kind of is the perfect gift.
Can you use it for like beard trimming? Because I imagine some large percentage of listeners of this podcast, given how hipsters are today, have beards or are dating someone with the beard or just have beard maintenance situations.
Absolutely. Now, I'm not super familiar with that situation, but the sleek chrome razor does appear to work as a trimming device as well as a full shaving device. I'm also given to believe that women are known to use razors to shave other parts of their bodies, and I have no reason to think that it wouldn't work for that either, even though it is aimed as a gift for men. So Harry's is gifting all of the listeners to the XX Gabfest with $5 off on their first purchase of a harrys.com package. So go to harrys.com and Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with the code XX. That's DOUBLEX. So go to harrys.com and check out these packages.
Check out these packages. So now that we have celebrated our fine men, it is time to scold them. A new study follows 25,000 Harvard Business School graduates, and it showed that men were more likely to be in positions of greater responsibility than the women they were with. This wasn't because the women were opting out. The vast majority were, in fact, working. But it's because they were making sacrifices and deferring to their husband's career. The study bursts the myth of egalitarian marriages and suggests that we women should stay away from rich, successful men because they will destroy us. Katie,
yes.
Did this study make you not want to get married? What was your conclusion when you read this? Did it make you wary of sort of the ways in which you could kind of subtly back off from your career in deference to the man that you might be with?
Okay, I like the way you phrased that, so I want to just say yes. however, I think, can I just play the naive for a second and ask, like, what did this study tell us that we don't already know? Like, it seemed to be saying that, you know, when you have kids, when a couple has kids, sacrifices need to be made, and the societal expectation that's held not only by the men but by the women, I think the poll results indicated that, is that the woman has more responsibility for childcare, right? And so the woman is the one who's more likely to put her career on hold. And it just seemed like something that's in the air. Like, we already know that. And so it's depressing and horrible. But I was just sort of like, we need a Harvard Business School study to tell us that the expectations for women are different.
Well, I mean, the stoking of man hatred and the kind of reframing of this, I think, is interesting. You're right. It doesn't tell us anything that we don't already know, but it does take us out of the box of women, children. Like, you know, work-life balance is about the little decisions that women make. It sort of gives a larger context to that conversation that we are endlessly having, which makes it seem like it's always up to the individual woman to be making tiny little choices about whether she wants to work more or less. It just kind of broadens the picture a little bit and shows you, you know, what contextually is going on when women are making these decisions.
Yes, but I was sort of already in the mindset where I was thinking, yeah, the partner, the husband should also be making a bunch of decisions and they should be working through it together. And so I was coming from a place of expecting egalitarian decision-making and seeing the reality fall short of that ideal. And just hearing this reinforced my assumptions.
June, do you feel lucky now?
I always feel lucky. But I actually had a response that I feel a little bit guilty about because I don't know if I'm being like anti-feminist or extra-feminist, because one of the things that it brought up for me was, they're Harvard Business School graduates who are involved here, but it is a self-reported sort of results about how they feel their careers are going and if they're kind of if they're achieving to the level of their expectations. And so I wonder if there's not also a bit of, you know, that thing that we've discussed many times of men tend to be just more positive about their situation. You know, they might do some retconning about, well, no, my career's right on target. Or also, whereas women are more likely to sort of either admit or to sort of down talk their achievements. You know, I'm not quite where I wanted to be.
That's an excellent point. I think you're absolutely must be right.
And the other part of it too is that maybe women take on too much blame. Maybe they're saying my career's not where I want it to be because of, you know, the way my marriage is not as egalitarian. I'm doing more childcare. I'm thinking more about childcare. Maybe they're blaming that for their perceived lack of success, when in fact it might be that their bosses, who's likely to be a man, is not giving them the opportunities that they deserve. Or maybe they're being put on a mommy track, even though they're not actually willing to do less, but maybe they're being put into that track against their will and they're just either not aware of or taking responsibility that isn't really theirs.
Also, this accepts the lean-in definition of success and happiness. Like, I keep waiting for us to conclude from such studies that the women are the lucky ones because the women have crafted possibly a life for themselves in which, you know, they get to have lots of variety in their life and are not necessarily, you know, climbing the ladder or working all the time. It's like assumes a very particular specific definition of success, which, you know, as we've learned, women in the vaunted Dutch women would say, screw that. Like, I'm the happy one. You know, I'm the lucky one because I get to do stuff in my day that's varied and I get to work some and do other things a little bit. And I'm not saying this facetiously. I actually believe this, right? So if you set up the study such that you tell the Harvard Business School graduates, what were your career expectations? Are you meeting those career expectations? And the women kind of look like failures. On the other hand, if I say that, I'm letting people off easy, right? Like, you want people to focus on these egalitarian marriages and say, let's actually make this decision in an egalitarian way instead of having the woman kind of kindly step back at every moment. Yeah, by default, just without really thinking about it. We're like, okay, honey, of course I should do this, that, and the other thing.
I really like the slate pitch embedded in what you just said, which is that, like, actually domesticity might be a happier, warmer, safer place for women than it is for men, just because, like, we have such a, you know, a cultural tradition of, like, making the home and the kitchen and everything the place where women go. And so, like, maybe it just is more comfortable to be there as a woman than it is to be there as a guy. And that could also be shading men's decisions to steer clear. Although they're also heroized for doing it.
Well, I also think for, like, humanity, not just for women, that if you redefined it as the women are the lucky ones, then the men would want that. Like, we would understand as a workplace that a holistic life in which people take lots of vacations and, of course, they're expected to spend some time with their loved ones, families, in whatever form their families come, like, that's the good thing. failing, you know, that that's not the failure. I think lots of other countries understand that, and we weirdly don't.
I mean, I am absolutely all behind that. I wish we all took more rest and took more time to not be working. However, I just want to inject a little bit of reality and say that that is not, or that doesn't appear to be the situation with these Harvard Business School women. I don't remember the exact number of hours they were working, but they weren't working. They didn't have a great work-life balance. I mean, they were still working an awful lot of hours. It's just that they weren't really paying off.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think we would all benefit from a better balance. But that did not appear to be what they were having instead of success.
Yeah, they were working a lot, but sort of not climbing the ladder. So it felt like, you know, it was inherently frustrating. OK, Katie, I'm going to just put you on the spot for my very last moment here. So would this kind of thinking, let's say you were faced with two men and one is called George and one is called Bob. And Bob is less ambitious than George. Like Bob is clearly going to be happy to, you know, let you be the dominant member of the union. Would you consider that in your head? Would that be part of your consideration? The way Linda Hirschman says, you know, basically, you know, marry down, ladies. Don't marry up, because marrying up is not going to get you where you want to go. You should marry down.
So this is tricky because I love my job, but I'm also a journalist, which is not, you know, going to be winning me the big bucks. So I guess it would depend on what he wants in terms of standard of living. You know what? It would be really great to find a partner who is into staying at home and letting me explore different career opportunities. Like, how could you turn that down? I also think ambition in anyone, like in a friend, in a potential partner, is like really admirable and cool. And
right.
I like being around people like that. So that's another factor.
Right.
So I am just going to skirt around your question and not answer it. You're welcome.
I don't actually think it's answerable. I mean, you know, it depends on who you love. It depends who you love more, George or whatever his name was, Bob.
So I think George and Bob, both of you should call Katie.
Yes. Call 1-800-KATIE-WALDMAN.
Open phones.
Open phones. All right, let's move on to our third topic. Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games.
Let's everybody think of one incident where Katniss Everdeen genuinely moved you.
When she volunteered for her sister at the reaping.
Excellent example. What else?
Oh, when she sang that song for Little Rue.
Oh, yeah. Who didn't get choked up at that?
Mm.
New York Times movie critic Manolo Dargis, always sensitive to feminist undertones in movies, calls her the boundary-smashing butch goddess of dystopian cinema. In a world where the male hero is still very much the standard, Katniss Everdeen is very unusual. She's a hunter, a fighter, and totally lacking in the kind of finesse that women are usually expected to have. How deeply feminist is this particular movie? So, Katie, I'll start with you. You've wrote a great blog post in Slate, which taught me many things about the feminist undertones of this movie. But before we get to the larger implications, Katniss herself, what did you think of the portrayal of her in Mockingjay Part 1, the awkward name of this movie? And by the way, for those of you who are not familiar with the Hunger Games series, this represents the final book, but they've broken it up into two different movies. So this is Part 1 of the finale, basically. What did you think of how Katniss was portrayed?
Well, so I think it's interesting that we're starting with Katniss because, yes, she is definitely a feminist idol for all the reasons that the article you cited say. But I think in this movie in particular, she's a little bit more weepy and dramatic or reactive, I think, than she has been in the past two movies where she's like a straight up butt-kicking action heroine. I mean, to me, this movie felt deeply feminist, but not necessarily because of Katniss.
That's what your great blog post taught me, because when I was reading all this commentary, I thought, well, just what you said, in previous movies, she's an incredible... I mean, the sort of gender switches in the Hunger Games series are really interesting, because you've got Peeta, who embodies all of the traditional feminine qualities. I mean, down to being a baker. He's like a baker and a nurturer, and he's the one who kind of smooths everything over, and he's the romantic. And she is a classic male heroine. She's kind of cantankerous. She's a fighter. I mean, down to the hunter-provider. Right? She's everything that a traditional caricature of male hero is. And yet in this movie, she's kind of muted. You know, she's guileless. She's confused. She gets frustrated. I mean, I kept kind of transporting myself back to Jennifer Lawrence of American Hustle. Mm-hmm. You know, I kept wanting her to say, "You're welcome." Like anytime she did one of those, yeah. one of those movie clips that she finally got right, to just like cut, "You're welcome, bitches," like that. But she didn't, that wasn't what came out of her in this movie. She was sort of hiding. And it's partly because of what portion of the action they chose. Like they stopped the book in a place where she was not participating in the action or the fighting or the saving. She was just kind of viewing it all, watching it.
Right. And I think that there is something subtly feminist about that, in that we don't see someone employing their delicate feminine wiles. Like, she is very artless in this movie. She is observing, reacting, and the purer her reactions are, like, the better it is for District 13, for the rebel movement. And I think that there is sort of a dichotomy in the movies between sort of male, straightforward, no-frills action and female machination. Mm-hmm. And she falls squarely in the male camp.
June, before we get to why it was Katie's theory about why it was deeply feminist, mm-hmm. did you have reactions to Katniss as a character in this particular movie?
I just loved that one of her great sort of action sequences in this particular movie, which for the reasons we've described as a little bit atypical of the series as a whole, that in this particular film, her big scene was going to rescue a cat, which is like the greatest thing ever as a huge cat lover, or mostly a lover of my own cat. I have just, it's such a fantasy to think that in the worst moment possible, somebody would go and rescue my cat.
Ugh, I hated that.
Why?
It was just a cat, whatever. That's terrible. All the cat lovers are going to write in. I'm sorry.
But wasn't she really rescuing her sister? She didn't really give a shit about the cat. She was just my sister went to rescue the cat. Yeah. And that's her tender, like her tender heart is with her. So anything involving her sister, or I guess PETA. What did you think about all the media meta-ness, the idea of using Katniss as a symbol in this movie? She's the Mockingjay. They're basically trying to package her as the face of the revolution.
So I think this is going to get into the deeper feminist themes. Okay. Because, yes, first of all, it's a really clever sort of – it's sort of like the Lego movie when they're trying to have it both ways. Like, we are a big crowd-pleasing product, but we're also this like smart, witty meta-narrative on what a crowd-pleasing product looks like these days. And so I think, you know, the movie is saying, we get it. We're staging a spectacle. It's really enjoyable. It's really fun. And – you know, maybe it doesn't have a soul. But as long as we know it, it's okay. But I also think that sort of inherent in the packaging of Katniss and sort of symbolizing her, making her into this object, this symbolic object, like there is a really kind of female-coded threat there, which is the threat of objectification. And so like the themes that the movie is exploring by showing human beings turned into the faces of larger causes and sort of losing their autonomy as they're like forced into these larger struggles, like that's something that women maybe have to deal with, especially because they are constantly confronting the pressures of image management and being turned into a symbol and turned into an object.
Interesting. So maybe all the stuff we were complaining about the Katniss character, her passivity, her unwillingness to participate in this movie, is actually a feminist strength, because that's the only reasonable response to this demand. If somebody is demanding very forcefully, you have to step up and be the face of something, you know, the feminist thing to do is just kind of hide from that.
And
you know?
I think, too, that she doesn't just want to be a face. I mean, there's a scene where they're trying to start doing these propaganda movies where there's like a wind machine blowing on her and there's, you know, faked backgrounds. And that doesn't work. She doesn't want anything to do with that, and she can't really talk herself into that. And that's a more sort of classic, you know, women being objectified sort of scenario. But then what she really can't resist and what she is just fully drawn to and fully commits to is actually taking action. That she's not interested in faking anything, but when she can really help and when she can save people and when she can actually do something, that's when she gets involved and she can't resist then.
Although the cruelty there is then they film her anyway.
Right.
You know, it's like they take that authenticity and they package it and they essentially steal it from her. So that's the extra twist.
And that maps really interestingly onto Jennifer Lawrence's narrative, I think, you know, because she is this sort of totally lacking in finesse. That's her persona, at least. Yeah. She goes out on the red carpet and photobombs people and says unpolitic things. And then that authenticity, that presumed authenticity, makes us love her and feeds back into the press cycle. And so I just, watching The Hunger Games, I kept connecting Katniss to J-Law.
Uh-huh.
And that was another interesting little meta twist.
Amazing.
So can we say that The Hunger Games is pro-women but anti-femininity?
Ooh, that's
good. And like anti-men but pro-masculine values?
Excellent. Yes, pro-masculine heroism. I love that. That is exactly what we will say, which you just said it. Okay. So now let's move on to our recommendations. I'll start with you, June. What do you have for us this week?
I want to recommend another Slate podcast, which is Dahlia Lithwick's relatively new podcast about the law and usually the Supreme Court, which is called Amicus. I mean, it's not such a big surprise that a podcast with Dahlia Lithwick would be amazing, but it is even more fantastic than I would have expected, because most weeks she talks with an attorney who's actually involved with the cases that she's talking about. So either somebody who argued a case in front of the Supreme Court, and she sort of asked them what that was like, and she also, you know, has clips from the oral arguments, or with a, you know, with the attorney of somebody who's appealing a death sentence. And so it's just an amazing show. It's most Saturdays, it appears, and it's just fantastic. So Dahlia Lithwick's amazing new Slate legal podcast, Amicus.
I'm going to recommend a story that has really, really wormed its way through my head this week, which is a story called Whipping Boy and the New Yorker by Alan Kurzweil. It's about a guy who bullied him in his year at a Swiss boarding school. I mean, really pretty brutally bullied him. And then Alan became obsessed with him and tried to track him down many, many years later, like in midlife. And it's just totally amazing what this guy became and what his philosophy of life is. And then there are many years of interacting with each other until Alan could finally put this to rest. So it's called Whipping Boy, and it's in last week's New Yorker. Katie, what do you have?
I actually have two, which is me overcompensating for the fact that I forgot that I needed recommendations, but there are two things that bubble up. And the first is this awesome podcast I've started listening to called Pitch. It's really bite-sized, manageable, 15 minutes an episode, and it is basically stories about music. So what is sound? What kind of restrictions are in place in institutions that play sounds, like bars? And the most recent episode was really cute. It was about second grade kids who were creating scores from squiggly lines and then singing the scores, interpreting them in their own way, and I loved it. And then the second recommendation was, it reminded me of the conversation that we were having about sexual violence in schools. And it is an assessment of Eminem, the rapper Eminem's career in Grantland. And it's really fascinating. It basically talks about whether maturity is a myth and whether it's possible for this artist to grow up if his most puerile impulses are consistently rewarded by the market.
I can never read enough about Eminem, so I will read that as soon as we get off the air here. Well, thank you to our producer, Ann Hepperman. Thank you to our managing producer of Slate Podcasts, Jill Meyer. Thank you to the executive producer of all the Slate Podcasts, Andy Bowers. If you want more information about this show, please go to our show page, slate.com/XX. Please go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest. If you have any comments about this show, would like to share or make recommendations for what we should talk about next, our email is XXGabFest@slate.com. Also for comments and recommendations, and you should also subscribe on iTunes to help your friends learn about our podcast. For June and Katie, and I'm going to include our producer Anne on this because she's so helpful, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.